Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett. Amna Nawaz is away on the NewsHour tonight. Bombings hit closer to hospitals in Gaza City, making conditions for civilians even more desperate, while the number of journalists killed also rises.
What this increasing number of deaths means is that our ability to understand what's happening in Gaza and increasingly what's happening in the West Bank diminishes.
Demand outpaces supply for a recently approved treatment to protect children from the respiratory virus, RSV. And David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on the outcome of this week's elections and how Joe Manchin's decision not to run for re-election could shake up the U.S. Senate. Welcome to the NewsHour. More than 100,000 civilians have fled south from northern Gaza over the last 2 days as Israel's week-old ground campaign intensifies. More than 11,000 Palestinians have been killed in the war, according to the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry. And the Israeli death toll from those initial attacks was revised down today from 1,400 to 1,200. Israeli officials gave no explanation for the change. Nick Schifrin has our update on another bloody day. And a caution, some images in this story are disturbing.
Today, the hospitals treating Gaza City's wounds of war have become the war's battlegrounds. This was the scene inside Gaza's Shifa hospital compound. Those left living scream, "Why, God, why?" Inside, a doctor narrates the aftermath. The injured line the hallway. Family members act as nurses. There is no dignity yet for the dead.
There's no treatment. My dad is lying there. Even the anesthetic has run out. May God help the doctors. There's nothing more they can do.
In this war, hospitals are also morgues. Hamas blamed an Israeli airstrike. Israel said tonight that these victims were killed by an errant Hamas rocket. Shifa is Gaza's largest hospital, located in western Gaza City. Israeli troops appear to be approaching from both the north and the south, and say it hides Hamas's command and control underground. Israeli Minister of Defense Yoav Gallant.
Those terrorists who are staying in the basements underneath Shifa tonight can hear the thundering sound of tank chains, the bulldozers that pound the ground. They hear it and tremble with fear.
Last night, a projectile hit inside the compound. Shifa is not just a hospital. It's become a tent city filled with thousands of families who considered it the safest place to shelter. Not anymore. Doctors said the projectile last night hit the hospital's courtyard and obstetrics department. Israel's defense forces said it had no information about the explosion. But by this afternoon, multiple Gaza hospitals appeared to be surrounded or under attack. Hundreds of Gazans who took shelter in Al-Nasser Hospital left waving white flags. They fled multiple hospitals in North Gaza by the thousands. Those who could walked the six-mile journey to what Israel calls a safe zone. Those who couldn't made the journey nonetheless. The old tried to comfort the young. Today's six-hour evacuation corridor was the longest one yet, after a U.S.-Israeli agreement to expand military pauses.
What did all these people do? The sick person, the one unable to walk, the child, the old man whose son was martyred and whose house was destroyed? What did we do?
Much more needs to be done. To protect civilians and to make sure that humanitarian assistance reaches them.
Today, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, as part of a visit to New Delhi alongside Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, made one of the most direct American criticisms of Israel yet.
Far too many Palestinians have been killed. Far too many have suffered these past weeks.
These are the gates to a living nightmare.
Those concerns are echoed by the international community. Days after visiting the Rafah border crossing, today, UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk called for Israel to be investigated.
Considering the predictable high level of civilian casualty and the wider scale of destruction of civilian objects, we have very serious concerns that these amount to disproportionate attacks in breach of international humanitarian law.
But the suffering goes on. Today, the UN said the war has pushed 400,000 Gazans into poverty in an area that for years has already been one of the globe's most impoverished. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
In the day's other headlines, President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping will meet next Wednesday for the first time in nearly a year. The White House announced the high-stakes talks on trade, Taiwan, and other disputes will come during an Asian-Pacific summit in San Francisco. A statement said the leaders will discuss ways to, quote, responsibly manage competition and work together where our interests align. President Biden has formally entered the first primary on the Democratic presidential calendar for 2024. Vice President Harris filed the paperwork today to get the ticket on the South Carolina ballot next February 3rd. The vice president was in Columbia, joined by Congressman Jim Clyburn. His endorsement in the state's 2020 primary set Mr. Biden on the path to victory after early primary losses.
So I'm here to first and foremost thank everybody because of what you did in 2020. We have then come into office and with your support, done a number of things that have been transformational for our country because of the work of the folks here in South Carolina.
The Biden team pushed for having South Carolina kick off the primary schedule to give black voters and other voters of color a bigger say in picking the nominee. New York Mayor Eric Adams has confirmed that the FBI seized phones and an iPad from him this past week. It's part of an investigation into his campaign finances. Agents had already searched the home of his top fundraiser. In a statement today, Adams said he has nothing to hide and is cooperating with the probe. In northern France, more than 100 towns faced severe flooding danger today after days of downpours. Overflowing rivers have spilled into streets and inundated homes. Some 200 schools have closed, and miles of farmland are also underwater.
The next season in April is compromised. I risk having oxidized strawberries, diseases, fungi. These are one-year-old plants, so I surely risk having zero production, or a really low one at minimum.
Forecasters say the region will stay on red alert for flooding through Saturday. The UN now says catastrophic flooding across East Africa is a once-in-a-century event. Unprecedented rain touched off deluges this week that killed at least 29 people in Somalia and forced more than 300,000 others from their homes. Skies cleared today in Mogadishu, but roads and residential areas were still underwater, along with more than 3 million acres of farmland. Northern Kenya has also been hard hit. Back in this country, Las Vegas hotel workers reached a tentative contract deal today with Wynn Resorts just hours before a strike deadline. The five-year deal follows similar agreements with Caesars and MGM, covering some 40,000 hotel and food service workers. Negotiations are continuing with 24 smaller casinos. The Big Ten Conference banned Michigan football coach Jim Harbaugh today from the final regular season games, starting with Penn State tomorrow. It's punishment for allegedly using scouts to steal play-calling signs from rivals. Michigan said it will ask a court to block the ban. On Wall Street, stocks recouped Thursday's losses and then some as interest rate worries eased a bit. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 391 points to close at 34,283. The NASDAQ rose 276 points. The S&P 500 added 68. And the National Toy Hall of Fame has a new class of inductees, led by the Fisher-Price Corn Popper. Fans voted to add the push toy designed to help babies walk. It had been a finalist more than once. The other inductees are baseball cards, Cabbage Patch Kids, and Nerf foam toys. But Barbie's friend Ken was passed over, despite the summer blockbuster movie. Still to come on the NewsHour, survivors of the Hamas attack on a music festival cope with the violence that has consumed the region. We hear a brief but spectacular take on rebuilding local news. And author Doug Melville tells the story of the country's first two black generals.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The Israel-Hamas war has led to the deadliest 4 weeks for journalists in over three decades. Yesterday, Amna spoke with the head of the Committee to Protect Journalists to understand what this means for those covering the war and for a world trying to get a clear picture of the ongoing conflict.
The war has taken a heavy toll, including on those documenting it. Almost daily, there are reports of journalists and their families killed in the conflict. This was the moment Al Jazeera's Gaza bureau chief, Wael Al-Dadu, a veteran journalist covering decades of conflict there, stopped reporting to mourn his own family. His wife, his son, daughter, and grandson, all killed in an Israeli airstrike on October 25th. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, this has been the deadliest war for journalists ever documented amid countless conflicts in the past few decades. Jody Ginsburg's the president of CPJ. Jody, welcome. So I want to put to you and share with our audience your numbers as of November 7th, the total number of journalists and media workers killed so far since October 7th, 34 Palestinian, 4 Israeli, 1 Lebanese, 8 journalists reported injured, 3 reported missing, 9 reported arrested. Jody, put these numbers and this war into context for us. What does this say about journalist access and safety in the war?
So as you said, this is the deadliest conflict for journalists that we have ever documented. And we have been documenting attacks on journalists at the Committee to Protect Journalists for over 30 years. For some context, last year we documented the killings of 68 journalists and media workers worldwide over the space of 12 months. And we've seen, as you said, 39 deaths in Israel, Gaza alone. It's incredibly dangerous. There are very few safe spaces in which journalists in Gaza can operate, and they're trying to report while they themselves are in danger.
Jody, I have to ask you about a recent allegation made by a pro-Israel advocacy group claiming that the New York Times and Associated Press were working with freelance journalists they say are aligned with Hamas. The New York Times and AP both deny that. But you now have Israeli outlets, too, labeling some journalists as Hamas propagandists. And we have to be clear, Hamas does run Gaza. So how can viewers make sure that what they're seeing is the full picture and not just what Hamas wants to get out?
Well, there are a variety of media outlets operating in Gaza, and that's been the case for many years. Journalists reporting for, as you say, Reuters, AP, AFP, international news outlets, as well as for local news outlets. And what's really important is that we have that plurality of voices who can help us build a comprehensive picture of what's happening in Gaza. There are no international news crews who are able to get into Gaza, to operate in Gaza. So we're absolutely reliant on those local Palestinian journalists to be our eyes and ears on the ground to tell us what's happening.
Well, those disturbing numbers we cited earlier look like this on the ground. I want to share with folks the moment that a Palestine TV correspondent, a man named Salman al-Bashir, was reporting live outside a hospital. He saw his own colleague being carried into the morgue. This is that moment.
Helmets. They're just emblems that we wear. They don't keep us safe at all. They do not keep us safe. We're victims live on air. We're just waiting our turn, one after the other. Our colleague Muhammad Abu Hatab was here just 30 minutes ago. He's been killed, along with his wife, his son, and his brother.
Jody, Muhammad Abu Atab was one of those 39 journalists killed. And I want to just put up this graphic as I ask you this question to show the names and the faces of those 39 journalists and ask you, as this war rolls on, as the death toll among journalists in particular more broadly mounts, what does that mean for our visibility into what is happening on the ground?
Well, first, I want to say thank you to you, PBS, for humanizing those individuals. It's very easy, I think, for the statistics to somewhat become numbing, become meaningless. Behind every one of those statistics is a person with a family, with colleagues and with friends. And as this rolls on, what this increasing number of deaths means is that our ability to understand what's happening in Gaza and increasingly what's happening in the West Bank diminishes day by day. We need journalists to be able to understand what's happening in Gaza, to understand what's happening in the West Bank, to be those reporting on the conflict.
And Jody, some Palestinians we've spoken to look at these numbers. They look at the previous killing of journalists like Shireen Abu Akleh in 2022, before the war, a killing that the IDF took a year to come out and apologize for. And they feel like journalists are not just being caught up in collateral damage, but they're being targeted. What would you say to that?
Well, what we do know is that there is a clear pattern of impunity. In fact, in May of this year, the Committee to Protect Journalists published a report called Deadly Pattern, which is a report on the killings of journalists by the Israeli military since 2001. And what we found was that between 2001 and September 2023, there were at least 20 journalist killings by the IDF. The vast majority were Palestinians, and no one has ever been charged or held accountable for these deaths. It's really important that when a journalist is killed, those killings are investigated and those responsible are held accountable.
That is Jody Ginsburg, president of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Jody, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Today, CPJ reported that a 35th Palestinian journalist has been killed, bringing the death toll of journalists killed in the war to 40. The day that started the war, October 7th, was a day of horrific carnage and terror, and nowhere more so than at the Nova Music Festival in southern Israel. The rave in the desert was shattered at dawn by Hamas attackers. Hundreds were killed and many hostages taken. Leila Molana Allen has been speaking with survivors of the massacre and those who rushed to help. And again, the images and accounts in this story are disturbing.
The final carefree moments of dancing till dawn. As the sun rose on October 7th, revelers at the Nova Music Festival heard a sound they never expected, gunfire. Laura and her husband ran for shelter in the only place they could, their camper van. For hours they hid, unable to block out the sounds of terror and murder outside.
They started to try to open the door. That moment my husband looked at me and told me, well, this is it. And my husband and I looked at each other and he told me he loved me. I told him I love him. And I closed my eyes.
At that moment, the Israel Defense Forces finally arrived.
And then they opened the door to hell. There were dead people in each car. People that were hiding inside the car, next to the car. And my husband drive between dead bodies and between burned car.
Laura came back today to find her van. Seeing it has compounded her despair.
It's getting harder every day. You understand better every day what happened, and you miss your dead friends every day a little bit more.
Hundreds of vehicles are still being brought to this graveyard of cars on Israel's southern border with Gaza. Many bear the scars of bullet holes and explosives where festival goers were attacked as they tried desperately to flee.
23-year-old Amit Ganish and her friends were ambushed by terrorists as they tried to escape.
Everybody that were alive in the car just ran. I ran through the forest and I ran like this because they were shooting after me.
And your friend's boyfriend was shot.
They killed everyone and even set the car on fire. Only after 5 days we realized he was dead. They found a very, very small piece of his brain and teeth, and there was no real grave to mourn for him.
For 9 hours, yes, Amit and her best friend Zohar hid inside a small bush, barely breathing.
I heard everything, all the screams of everyone, and I was in despair. I believed I was going to die that day. I knew I was going to die and said goodbye to everyone.
Like many survivors, Amit was saved not by the IDF, but by an Israeli citizen who ran straight toward the danger to help. Eren Massas woke that morning to find his country under attack. Barely thinking, he grabbed his gun and began to drive.
After a kilometer or something like this, one of the terrorists come in front of me, and I understand the situation, and I said to myself, okay, I'm in a war.
He shot the militant and drove on. As word spread, Eren's phone began to fill with pleas for help from parents he'd never met.
Our breacher location is hurt from a gunshot in his back. Names. I don't know who are they.
For hours, Eren drove back and forth, seeking out young people hiding in terror across the plains. Then, suddenly, a parent Eren did know, an old friend from his army days, called.
Eren, help me. Omri, my son, inside. You know him. You know him when he was a baby. And then when I walk around, I saw Omri dead. And I tell him, I'm not found him. I told him, I'm not found him. I cannot see him. Maybe later. I call you later. And Omri dead. He sent me a message after 3 days that they found Omri. But I know. I already knew.
As Eren approached the central site of the festival, the scale of the horror began to unfold before his eyes.
I start shouting, who is alive? If there are any lives, if somebody heard me, just look at me. And then I saw body after body and after body.
The further he walked, the darker the nightmare became.
There is a group of people who started to run. They fell. They just take the gasoline from the generator of the lights to the party and they burn them. This is children.
So these kids were trying to escape and
that's
they captured
right.
them and they burned them alive.
That's right.
Having saved as many of the living as he could, next, Eren stayed to help the dead.
This is the truck that I took from the party with that, and I just put inside dead bodies. All my uniform was on blood.
You were covered in blood?
Of course. There is 100 bodies that I took with my both hands.
Eren immediately rejoined the army after the attacks. But that day, he was all alone. Back home with his 4 young children, he's trying to process the burden of such loss.
When I think about my children, it breaks my heart because it's not easy. It's really not easy. I guess every parent in the world, every human being, to see so many deaths, so many blood in one place, in one moment, it's not humanity. It's not humanity.
Each survivor is trying to find their own way back to humanity. At this pop-up healing center outside Tel Aviv, dozens of therapists have volunteered to help.
The few people that came on the first day were hollow. It was like death was all around them.
Here, they're slowly learning to feel safe in their bodies and minds again, their souls, and to dance to the music they went to share in love, but ended in hell.
So much evil. They saw so much evil and so much darkness. And for a lot of them, it's hard for them to get back to life or to feel that they're allowed to be happy in other places. But here, it's healthy and it's healing and it's life.
But in a country where everyone has been touched by this tragedy, many are not yet ready to begin healing. When Eren closes his eyes at night, the images play over and over.
What I see is not normal people. I see it with not an eye, with not a mouth, and I wake up. Every day for the last month, this is what I saw.
Tomorrow, Eren is being deployed to fight in Gaza. His battle is far from over. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Leila Milana Allen in Haifa, Israel.
Now we'll look at an illness that's dangerous for babies, made worse by a shortage of drugs to treat it. Amna is back with this report recorded earlier.
Among children under the age of 5, RSV leads to as many as 80,000 hospitalizations and up to 300 deaths a year. It's the number one cause of hospitalization for infants under a year old. Dr. Celine Gounder is an epidemiologist and senior fellow at KFF. She also hosts the podcast Epidemic, Eradicating Smallpox. Celine, it's good to see you. And let's just start with what it is that makes RSV so dangerous for young children in particular. What does it do to their systems?
Well, RSV, or really any viral respiratory infection, leads to inflammation in the airways, which can lead to mucus, could lead to thickening of the lining of the airways. And between the two of those, you can get blockages of the airways, especially in young infants who have smaller airways to begin with.
So there are approved drugs to treat it. They're available as shots. There is this nationwide shortage. Is high demand the sole reason for that shortage? And if so, can we boost supply?
There is a new monoclonal antibody that's delivered as a shot. Its brand name is Beyfortus, that is new this season to help protect the youngest of infants. The challenge is really manufacturing. And based on what I'm being told by the CDC and pharmaceutical companies, the supply that we have available right now is the supply that we're going to have available for the season. It simply just takes too long to manufacture more to have more available this season.
So that shortage has now led the CDC to issue guidelines saying who should be prioritized. Who are they saying should get those shots first, and who does that leave out?
So the youngest of infants, so those under the age of 6 months, as well as other infants who might have underlying medical conditions that predispose them to severe RSV, and pediatricians can help parents figure that out. There are alternatives. So there's an older monoclonal antibody against RSV called Synagis that is also effective in protecting infants. And that is being recommended for those between the ages of 8 and 19 months as an alternative. And then there's a third option, which is to vaccinate pregnant women. Those pregnant women will then produce antibodies to the RSV vaccine and pass those on through the placenta and through breast milk to protect their infants in that way.
Celine, what should we understand about the cost of all of these treatments too? Does that impact who is able to get it? Is it covered by insurance?
Well, under the Affordable Care Act, insurance companies do not have to cover this until a year after the initial recommendation. However, the big insurance companies are covering the RSV vaccine for pregnant women. So even already now, many pregnant women will have coverage. It's also been challenging, however, to educate obstetricians about the need to vaccinate pregnant women against RSV to help reduce some of the issues we're having with shortages with the other options for infants. And also educating pharmacists who work in pharmacies that it is perfectly safe to be vaccinating pregnant women and, in fact, should be the norm.
So a lot of parents are seeing the headlines about these shortages. We've been hearing about looming triple-demics, right, coming in this next fall and winter season. What is your advice to them on how they should proceed, especially if their child isn't eligible under those CDC guidelines?
Well, if your child is not eligible, do talk to your pediatrician about Synagis. It is an alternative for the older infants. And then it's the common sense measures that we take to reduce the risk of infection, not just with RSV, but also with influenza, COVID, and other respiratory infections. So if you're sick, stay away from other people. If other people are sick, keep them away from your child to the best that you can. I know that can be challenging if a child is in daycare, for example. Masks do work. So if someone is sick and absolutely has to be around your child, maybe they're a caregiver, they should be wearing a mask to reduce the risk of transmission to your child. Hand washing is also an important piece of this. And then a way to reduce risk in general in various indoor spaces is open your windows, open doors if you can, or put in a HEPA air filtration unit to reduce the risk of transmission in that space.
You know, more broadly, when you look at this, the issue of demand being so high for a drug seems to go against the trend of vaccine hesitancy and, frankly, skepticism in science that we saw, particularly in the pandemic. How do you look at that?
I think there's a few things at play here. I think some parents really have seen, whether it's their child or other young children, get very sick from RSV, end up in the hospital from RSV. And so it's very real for them. I think another issue, though, is that COVID was politically politicized in a way that RSV has not been. And I think between those two different factors, we're seeing a difference in demand and uptake.
That is Dr. Celine Gounder, epidemiologist and senior fellow at KFF. Dr. Gounder, always good to see you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
As the war in Gaza continues, the Biden White House is facing fresh pressure over how to approach its relationship with Israel. On that and more, we turn to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. It's good to see you both.
You too, Jeff.
So, David, I want to start with your reaction to Israel agreeing to put in place four-hour daily humanitarian pauses in its assault on Hamas in northern Gaza.
Yeah, I think it's a start. I think that Israel has to do a few things here. The first is obviously defeat Hamas. There can be no peace in the Middle East as long as Hamas is there. And so that's what you might call the near enemy. But the real enemy and the far enemy is Iran. And I was with a group of foreign policy experts last week, and one of them made a smart observation, which was, of all the nations of the world, who's had the most effective foreign policy in the last several years? And it's been Iran. They've surrounded Israel with a bunch of terror groups, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, Hamas. And in order to defeat Iran, or at least stand up to Iran, you've got to have help in the neighborhood. And so you've got to have help in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt. And those regimes want to help you. They don't like Iran at all. But their populations are getting more and more furious about what's happening in Gaza. And so in order to defeat Iran and keep your allies in with you, you've just got to be as humanitarian as possible. And so I think even aside from the moral reasons to spare the suffering of the people in Gaza, there are strategic reasons Israel should be as humanitarian as possible.
Jonathan, when David talks about the moral and strategic reasons, the administration was pushing for a multi-day pause. And John Kirby, the National Security Council spokesperson, said that these, you know, four-hour-long pauses were a direct result of President Biden's contacts and conversations with Netanyahu.
Right. This is the public manifestation of hours, if not weeks, of private consultations. I was going to say lapel shaking, but of the president, the secretary of state, and his shuttle diplomacy trying to impress upon Prime Minister Netanyahu that, you know, you must have, if you're not going to do a ceasefire, which the administration is against, at least do a humanitarian pause. Gaza is suffering. There's no water, there's no food, there's no fuel, there's none of the basic necessities. You must defend yourself against Hamas, but you also must do so in a manner befitting a small d democratic nation. And so it'd be great if it were over several days, but the fact that there will be pauses over hours, it is the result of the president pushing Prime Minister Netanyahu to do the right thing, and hopefully that will lead to more.
What's your assessment of the way in which President Biden has navigated these competing interests and competing pressures?
Yeah, I think he's done quite well. I think the clarion call that Hamas has to be defeated, Hamas is a threat to the region. I think he might be alone in his administration in feeling that so strongly, not quite alone, but he's certainly been a force. And so I think he's put America and rallied the West into an idea that Israel, there was relative stability, and Hamas is not like Fatah. Hamas is something different. And I think one of the tragedies of what's happened over the last month is in a lot of people's minds that difference between Hamas and Fatah has been elided. And Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, they recognize the state of Israel. They've been trying, you know, to get to some sort of two-state solution. They play rough. And, you know, even in the Yasser Arafat days, there was terrorism. But often it was terrorism with the purpose of building leverage to get to a better settlement. Hamas is not like that. Hamas is about homicide, and it's about genocide, and it's about mass murder. And I think the president's been very clear about that. And it's because he's been doing this in the region for a long time. So I think this is a case where his age has really paid off.
Let's shift our focus to Tuesday night's election results. One thing was certainly clear, that abortion rights, reproductive rights, abortion access is politically popular no matter where it appears on the ballot post the Supreme Court overturning Roe. What were some of your other takeaways?
that was the main thing, whether you are in a so-called blue state, but especially if you're in a red state. I looked at sort of, let's just take Governor Glenn Youngkin in Virginia, who made it a point of saying, I will go for a 15-week abortion ban, just give me both, give Republicans control in both bodies of the legislature, and I'll get it done. So on Earth 2, that plays well, because that's what they want. But the rest of us on Earth 1, and particularly suburban white women in the Northern Virginia suburbs, looked at what happened with Dobbs and like, no. We've seen what has happened in other states around the country, particularly Florida, with a 6-week ban. We do not want that to happen here. Glenn Youngkin didn't get what he wanted in Virginia. Ohio Republicans didn't get what they wanted. Ohio, that Trump won by double digits, mm-hmm. now has in its state constitution, ruby red Ohio, access to abortion. Kentucky, Governor Beshear, reelected with that unbelievably powerful ad at the very end of the young woman who looks directly at the camera and blames David Cameron for wanting to institute a policy that would force her to carry her stepfather's child after he raped her. For Republicans who think that running on abortion is going to be the winning formula in 2024, Tuesday night should have been the wake-up call.
And David, you wrote a column this past week where the thesis was pretty evident based on the headline. It was, Democrats, you can chill out now.
Yeah.
Why?
We go for subtlety in our headlines at the right times.
Right.
Yeah, and I, you know, it was an emotional roller coaster week. So in the beginning of the week, there's the Times-Siena poll, which shows Trump in a bunch of battleground states, and Democrats are like, hair on fire, those who have hair. And then the election results come in, and yet again, as consistently since Donald Trump has been elected president, Democrats have a good night. And so one of my points was that the polls have to be looked at with a grain of salt. And not just because all polls have to be looked at with a grain of salt, because we're in a different culture now. Through most of our careers, presidential approvals go up and down. But over the last, since 2005, the country's been such a sour mood, presidents have spent 77% of their time with their favorability ratings underwater. People just blame the president. So when a pollster calls them and people are upset with the country, they say, yeah, I'm against the president. They're venting. They're not voting. And so my point was, in this kind of climate, we have to understand that what people tell pollsters could be about how they feel, but it's not necessarily the decision they're going to make in a year.
Meantime, Democratic Senator from West Virginia, Joe Manchin, announced this past week that he's not going to seek re-election. In some ways, it's not surprising, given that it would have been really difficult, if not impossible, for him to win re-election. But what's the impact on the Senate and on the party?
Well, the impact on the Senate is the Democrats are going to lose a seat that they pretty much thought that they were going to lose, and that it was going to be a very tough re-election effort on Senator Manchin's part if he went for it. Most likely was going to lose. Immediately, it means that their chances of hanging on to the Senate just diminish, because it's basically 50-50. And so that means that Senator Tester in Montana, Senator Sherrod Brown in Ohio, at least it gives the party, the Democrats, more time, more energy, more money to focus on those races. But I would also say focus in on Texas and Congressman Colin Allred, who's looking to unseat Senator Cruz. Tough, that's going to be an uphill battle. Everyone thought that they were going to be the one. Beto O'Rourke thought he was going to be the one to be the next senator from Texas. But I think Congressman Allred could be that person. And Senator Manchin getting out maybe frees up some resources for the DNC to push his way.
What's the legacy that Joe Manchin leaves behind?
He saved the Biden administration. And so the Biden administration, and if you remember a few years ago, wanted to spend $4 trillion to pump up the economy. And he said, no way. It was more like $1 trillion. And as a result, if we had spent $4 trillion instead of $1 trillion, the inflation, which we really suffered from, would have been astronomical. And the Biden administration would be in much worse shape if our inflation had hit like double digits, which it could have, if overstimulating to that degree. So Democrats don't like Joe Manchin, but he did save their bacon.
Before we wrap up, I want to put a marker on these latest comments from former President Donald Trump, who in an interview with Univision last night threatened to weaponize the DOJ against his opponents if he's reelected.
They've done indictments in order to win an election. They call it weaponization. And the people aren't going to stand for it. But yeah, they have done something that allows the next party. I mean, if somebody, if I happen to be president and I see somebody who's doing well and beating me very badly, I say, go down and indict them. Mostly that would be, you know, they would be out of business. They'd be out. They'd be out of the election.
I spoke with Devlin Barrett, a Washington Post reporter, this past week, who not only reported that former President Trump wanted to do it, but that there are lawyers, conservative lawyers, who are putting together a plan and writing executive orders for how he could do it if he wins re-election.
It's got a name. It's called Project 2025. Those plans, it's called the 180-day playbook. People who want to be a part of that administration, if it comes in, they can send in their resumes to that particular project. And what the former president said there, what he is saying are things he tried when he was president. Remember, at the very end of his administration, he was upset with Bill Barr because Bill Barr didn't move to arrest Joe Biden when Joe Biden was his political opponent.
Yeah.
The word for it is authoritarianism, indicting your political opponent. And I do think there's another Republican or Trumpy plan, which would, right now in the federal government, there are 4,000 political appointees who the president appoints and thousands of civil servants. And there's a plan afoot to gut as many as 50,000 of the civil servants and replace them with partisan political people.
That's Schedule F.
Yeah, Schedule F. And that would decimate our civil service, but it would also lead to apparently the complete politicization of the Justice Department. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just idle talk by Trump. There's actually plans afoot, as Jonathan said, to put this into effect, and that is truly scary.
David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, thanks as always.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Steve Waldman is the founder and president of Rebuild Local News, a nonpartisan nonprofit working to counter the collapse of local news and strengthen democracy. He's also the co-founder of Report for America. That's a national service program that places journalists in newsrooms across the country. Tonight, he shares his brief but spectacular take on how to rebuild local news.
Local news is in collapse. There's all sorts of evidence that when you don't have local news, you have lower voter turnout, more alienation, more polarization, people at each other's throats, more misinformation. I mean, it's really a terrible thing for communities to not have local news. On the community level, local news organizations are often unifying figures. They're the places where you have obituaries of interesting people who played an important role in the community, or the review of the community theater. The things in the community that tie them together are given voice through community news. At least 1,800 communities right now don't have any source of local news. What we're finding is that when there's a vacuum, it gets filled by other types of information, often misinformation, or national news, which may be accurate but tends to be more polarizing. Part of what happens when you consume news that is very partisan or national in nature is that you tend to think of your opponents as your enemies, whereas when you have local news, you still have disagreements, but you might actually see that person at the Little League game or at the supermarket the next day, and you know they're a human being. We created Report for America to put reporters into communities to cover on local affairs. And the impact is amazing. I remember one in Eastern Kentucky where the reporter got there, and it turned out that the folks there were complaining for a long time about not having clean drinking water, and no one was paying any attention. And he just started writing stories about the drinking water, and before you know it, people in the state legislature were paying attention. And things like that happen all the time in communities throughout America of problems that aren't getting addressed because no one is watching the store. To solve this crisis, we need the commercial, local media sector to reform, get better at connecting with their communities, and be more locally owned. We're going to need philanthropy, large and small, to support community media. And then third, we're going to need some public policy help. It has to be done really carefully, but it can be done. At the end of the day, community journalism is not going to survive without the support of the community. And that can mean subscribing to a local newspaper, even if you don't love it. Subscribe to it, engage with it, tell them what they're doing wrong, but subscribe to it.
I'm Steve Waldman, and this is my brief but spectacular take on how to rebuild local news.
You can watch more brief but spectacular videos online at pbs.org/newshour/brief. This Veterans Day weekend, Americans across the country will honor those who have served our nation in uniform. A new book explores and honors the legacy of two exceptional veterans whose contributions have gone largely unknown until now. Author Doug Melville recounts his family history and tells the barrier-breaking stories of father and son Benjamin O. Davis, Sr. and Jr., the country's first black generals. He recently told me how watching the movie Red Tails, George Lucas's 2011 film about the Tuskegee Airmen, inspired him to write the book Invisible Generals, Rediscovering Family Legacy and a Quest to Honor America's First Black Generals.
So I was invited to a screening, an advanced screening of the movie Red Tails. And when the commander of the Red Tails came out on screen, it was played by actor Terrence Howard. But while I was thinking that they were going to say General Colonel Davis, who was commanding the Tuskegee Airmen, the name that they used was Colonel Bullard. I was quite upset about it. I went home, I tell my dad, I was furious, and he said, if you think changing the names are bad, why don't I tell you the full family story? And he shared with me the story of the Invisible Generals. I was so inspired, Jeff, that I immediately said, I have to be the one to bring this story to the world so the true heroes can get their stories out into the universe.
And Benjamin O. Davis, Sr. and Jr., obviously, they were father and son. And at the start of World War II, there were 335,000 Americans who were enlisted in the U.S. Armed Forces. But there were only two black officers, the Davises.
Yeah, so Ben Davis, Sr., in 1901, was elevated to officer by President McKinley. He then started his family. His wife dies in childbirth. He brings his son to go for a plane ride in a barnstorming traveling airplane exhibit. And he comes down from that ride and goes, Daddy, I want to be a pilot. And Ben Sr. said, I will help you live your dream. And that was when he started training Ben Davis Jr. to go through what it would take to graduate from West Point. Because of segregation, Ben Sr. knew that unless it was through graduating at the top of West Point, his son would never get the opportunity to live his dream. So he sells the family house in Washington, D.C., relocates to Illinois so he can get the signature of the only black congressman in the United States, Oscar DePriest, and then they enter West Point Military Academy without them knowing he was black. And this was in 1932.
And when Ben Davis Jr. was at West Point, he was obviously the only black cadet. He was ostracized, he was ignored as a matter of policy. How did he cope with that?
Well, this is really the mental fortitude and leadership that makes me feel he was the greatest general and greatest West Point grad of all time. When the cadets realized and the administration realized that they had let a black cadet into West Point, immediately they said, we will silence him until he drops out. Ben Jr. called Ben Sr. and said, Dad, I know they're going to silence me. And he said, son, there's 8 million blacks on the outside world that are rooting for you. Put a date on the wall of graduation in 1936, and no matter what anybody does to you, make sure you graduate at the top third of the class. 4 years went by. No human interaction outside the line of duty. No one talked to him. No one spoke to him. He couldn't eat at the tables with other cadets because he wasn't getting the permission to sit. Yet, he was able to still graduate in the top third of his class in the class of 1936.
And fast forward to the time when FDR was trying to get reelected, he called up Benjamin Davis Sr. for advice. And that is what gave rise to the Tuskegee Airmen. Is that right?
That's exactly right. FDR assigned Ben Davis Sr. as the head of Negro policy in the military so he could work with him directly. When asking Ben Davis Sr. how he could get the black vote, as he was the highest ranking black in the military, he said, you must ensure equal opportunity for black and white Americans in the United States. And in the military, you must ensure equal opportunity by allowing blacks to fly airplanes, which at that time was not something that was allowed to do. And when FDR told Ben Sr. who would lead that if that was something that I had decided to do, and Ben Sr. said, my son. His son would then go down to Tuskegee, and that would be the start of the Tuskegee Airmen that we all know and are familiar with.
That's incredible. Benjamin Davis Jr., when he retired from the military, he had just a consequential second act. Tell me more about that.
When Ben left the military in 1970, he couldn't get a job in the private sector as a pilot. No one would hire him because some of the evil segregation rules were still de facto in place in the private sector. So the government created a special assignment role in the Department of Transportation Aviation. And the first assignment was, how can we get commercial travel in aviation as safe as military travel in aviation? There were a lot of hijackings and skyjackings at that time when people were starting to fear commercial travel. So what he decided to do was implement national airport security for your baggage and for your person, which is exactly what we see today in every airport worldwide. He also led the development of the Air Marshal Program and trained 4,000 officers. That then led to the Carter administration, and that was where he led the creation of the federally mandated 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. And his name actually was called Mr. 55 at the Pentagon.
I will tell you, Doug, since this book landed on my desk, I keep coming back to a picture in here of Benjamin Davis Jr. and his wife of 60-plus years, Agatha. Because what is so striking to me is that their grace, their strength, and their dignity comes through. It was amazing that they were able to succeed and thrive and contribute so much to this country under conditions that were set up for their failure.
Yeah, you know, Ben always lived by one thing that he would tell me over and over. Doug, you have to use the system to defuse the system. You cannot complain about something and fix something at the same time. So if you want to evolve a policy, if you want to evolve a practice, the first thing is you have to be part of the organization, then build a voice, then get a vote, and then over time, the impossible may seem long, but in time, you can accomplish the impossible.
The book is Invisible Generals. It's about Benjamin Davis Senior and Junior. Doug Melville, you did right by them both.
Thank you so much.
Be sure to watch Washington Week with The Atlantic tonight here on PBS. Jeffrey Goldberg and his panel discuss Senator Joe Manchin's decision not to seek re-election and how the issue of abortion rights could help Democrats in 2024. And watch PBS News Weekend tomorrow for a look at a program that uses horses to help military veterans with PTSD and depression. That is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett. Have a good night and a great weekend.